or anything that seems relevant to what we do here. And it's nice for me, it's kind of important for me to be able to hear what kind of concerns you have and interests you have, and hopefully address those directly rather than guessing ahead of time what would be an interesting talk for you. So I know that most of you prefer a talk, but once in a while I think it's nice to do this way. So hopefully some of you will have some burning issues that you've been carrying for a while you want to ask, or as we can go on with the discussion, something will come up. Yes?
On Thursday night, we paid a lot of attention to the breath, and I find myself, when I pay close attention to the breath, I get sad, especially, and I find, like, the end of the breath, I always try to avoid it. And the sadness is especially at the end of the breath.
Yeah.
And I've also been thinking a lot about death. And I was wondering if you want to talk at all about, I don't know, if there's any more to say about between death and the end of the breath.
Great. Well, for kind of background for some people, the breath is very interesting. And because there's such a strong connection between our inner psychology, in a sense, our inner dispositions towards life, and the way in which we breathe, a careful study of the breath will often reveal some of our inner dispositions, our attitude towards life. And it's very fascinating to me how different attitudes we have get embedded in the way in which we breathe or the way in which we pay attention to the breath. There are for people for whom they want to hold on to things all the time, and in that holding on will not really be willing. That holding on gets translated to how they breathe. They can breathe in fully. They're very happy to breathe in and take in air, but there's a little reluctance to let go of the breath, because that means giving up what they've acquired. Some people feel somewhat uncomfortable with the out-breath, especially the end of the out-breath, because it's kind of a letting go. You let go of everything you've had, and the end of the out-breath, there's even more letting go, and it tends to be kind of vague. The sensations of the breath aren't so distinct. And sometimes you find people who feel uncomfortable with the out-breath, or especially the end of the out-breath, because it's a lack of control or lack of security or lack of clarity that might be there. And so they might feel a bit afraid or perhaps a little bit sad. Some people, I've known people who were reluctant to take a breath in because their attitude towards life was one of, life is kind of oppressive, it's a burden, and so they just don't want life to kind of impinge on them. And so that translates into the breath, is they don't want to take in anything from life around them. So they'd rather not breathe in. So sometimes they'll breathe out quite happily, and then they'll hold the breath for a while. And, eventually they have to breathe in, but there's kind of a reluctance to breathe in. Now, I don't know what percentage of the population will have some attitude like this embedded in the way that they breathe, but I think that it's quite high, especially if it's, if you look at it sometimes. Most of us, probably all of us, we'll find at different times certain emotions are expressed or embedded in the way in which we breathe or affect the way we breathe. If we get afraid, the breath tightens up. So it's interesting what happens if you start paying attention to the breath very carefully. And what Elizabeth talked about the difficulty with the end of the out-breath, is probably the most common manifestation of what I'm talking about. And more often, I'm familiar with people talking about it feeling afraid at the end. And feeling sad, I think, could also be an expression of it. I think that it's very important to make space for that and allow that to happen, and not to kind of space out or disconnect with the breath at that point where it's vague or not so clear, but actually give a little bit extra emphasis there and let the sadness have its time in the sun, have its time in the light, and really show itself. Because if it stays hidden, then it can't kind of move through you. It can't do what it needs to do. And there's none of these emotions are to be. No one needs to be afraid of their emotions. What they need to do is find a healthy way of letting the emotions move through them, And so sadness is one of them. And I know it's common enough for some people to spend time in their practice having some grief or some sadness bubble up, because if it's been buried there for a long time, it needs to come to the surface. And then, you know, it comes for a while and then it passes, and then the person might not have it anymore. So you might want to ask your question again so that I can, because I kind of was, that was all introductory and I lost track of your question.
Also how I've been thinking a lot about death and how the end of the breath relates to death.
Well, death, yes.
We can't hear over the sound.
Oh, but you can hear me? Can you hear the mic's not working? Oh, I thought it was. Okay, is it working better now? Not working. Oh, it was booming before. Well, thank you for saying that. So let's see if that works any better. So let's see, is that any better now? What, I wonder what happened. The battery's already low. So let's see. Yeah. Well, I think the angle's okay. It's just. That's a. We have only like 5 minutes of battery. Yeah, yeah.
That red light on.
Yeah. But the battery works. I mean, the battery isn't. That's it. It's the battery. Yeah. Amazing. Huh. Okay, so we'll see what that's like and see if this battery's. Yeah? Okay, so the connection between death and the end of the out-breath. Well, death is kind of a letting go, the kind of ending, and the out-breath is a letting go and kind of an ending. And if someone is afraid or sad or about letting go, they can manifest itself both in the breath and in death. Now, is this working okay? Because I hear a little echo or a little kind of, I'm kind of troubled by hearing myself today. So, but I'm willing to go on if it's okay with all, it works for everyone else? If it works for everyone but me, that's okay. So, you know, it might be a great opportunity, the end of the out-breath, to face some of the deeper fears, existential fears that a person might have. And you should feel lucky you have the opportunity.
I guess I was also thinking in terms of, I don't know if it's the intimacy, I guess, with death or something, and the intimacy with the end-breath. I don't know. I can't really explain. I just keep feeling this need to be close to death. I don't know, that sounds kind of strange. And wanting this kind of intimacy with it.
One of the, there's maybe half a dozen or so meditation practices in Buddhism, in Theravada Buddhism, which are very common and kind of not exactly universally advocated for people, but close to it. And one of those half a dozen or so is the reflection on death. Often it's a reflection practice, a contemplative practice, where you think about death and kind of bring it to mind. But also visualizing death sometimes in your imagination. And also classically spending some time with a corpse. And in that it's close to a universal kind of practice, it's considered very, very beneficial for helping a person not become more morbid or depressed, but rather helping them kind of appreciate much more deeply the significance of life, the value of life, the appreciation of life, and their fear around death, their fears around life, and really come to terms with that. Death has a way of clarifying our values and our intentions. And so I can well imagine someone is very strongly drawn to spend some time being close to death, because not out of a morbid interest, but rather as a liberating interest, as interest to really kind of get to the bottom, to the depth of what it's like to be alive, what it's like to be a human being, and really face the issue of life and death in a way that's really honest. So, you know, if you're feeling drawn towards that, I'm very supportive, and you know, do your contemplation, your reflections on death. The one of the things you find in Southeast Asia is that monastics will sometimes go and find a corpse they can sit with. Because classically, they would they had charnel grounds, and so they were, you know, every little village had their charnel ground on the edge of the village, and so it was pretty easy to go out, just wander out to the charnel grounds and see the corpses there. In our kind of sanitary society, the corpses are not so easily readily available unless it's someone close to us, a loved one, and who maybe died, and you know, that we know in our home or something. But one of the few places in modern society where it's sometimes possible to spend time with a non-relative corpse, and sometimes is in teaching hospitals. When I was in, you know, I've known people who've gone to, teaching hospitals where they have anatomy labs and get permission to go there and spend some time with a corpse. When I was a freshman in college, I took a drawing class, and in the middle of the quarter, the teacher took us to the anatomy department and the whole drawing class in order to spend, we spent 2-3 hour sessions with this corpse, and he said the reason for, and we were drawing it, and he said the reason he gave for doing it was that people's drawings were always a lot stronger after that, and it made a big impact on people, and it was the first time that I'd been with a corpse, so it had a big impact on me. And remember the first day I went, I drew the foot, because I felt like the foot was about as far away from death as I could get, it's, you know, and still kind of be relating to the corpse. And so I didn't realize that that's what I was doing until, I guess, a little bit later. So the next day we went back for the to do it. So then I drew the face, because did an etching of the face, because I figured the face was kind of really to get it there and admit it. This is what I was dealing with. And yes.
Been watching a lot of the Olympics. Have you been watching any Olympics? A
little bit.
So what comes to my mind is always kind of this Buddhist overlay on real life. So watching, so the two things that are saying to me is the issue of clinging and attachment. Attachment bringing suffering. So here you have these star athletes who cling to the idea of being the best, and it's inevitable they're going to, most of them will suffer.
Yes. Yeah, I often feel, a little bit I've seen, I often feel actually kind of sad watching the Olympics because of that reason. I see the joy of the person who's won, but I see the sorrow of the people who, you know, silver's not good enough.
So my thought is, given our culture, and it's more or less a worldwide culture, that we desire to excel and we work hard, and all these are really excellent, seems to me, traits and motivations and good use of energy, and yet it sets you up for suffering. And I'm wondering, from a Buddhist perspective, then, would you like perhaps say Olympics is like a no-no then, because you're just setting yourself up for suffering? Or is it a positive, and then that's just life, that there is suffering? Can you see what I'm trying to look at from a Buddhist perspective, how do you view the Olympics?
If the Buddha was going to compete in the Olympics, how would he? How would he have done that?
He wouldn't.
He probably would. If he got in silver or bronze or came in last, he probably wouldn't have suffered.
He wouldn't have suffered. So do you think then the effort to try for it is Buddhist, and then the letting go of the loss, that would be where it comes in, or how you could apply the Buddhist perspective?
Yeah, I think we have to look at the motivation. And often the motivation is really key to understanding these kinds of questions. So what's the motivation someone has for being in the Olympics? And I can imagine some pretty unwholesome motivations, egocentric motivations. And I can imagine some wholesome motivations. If a person is doing it because their whole self-esteem is tied into winning. And some of these people who've been taken as children to be trained, and there seems to be so much pressure, national pressure and coach pressure, and their whole life is only about winning. It seems a very unhealthy motivation is tied to it. Like so much is at stake of their personal, well-being and self-esteem and self-worth and the love or appreciation from the people around them. That it's when there's that much unwholesome connections to the activity, I think it's a setup for a lot of suffering if the person loses. If the person wins, it might also be a setup for suffering because the joy is only temporary. And then a year or two later, the person no longer has those abilities and the person doesn't know how to relate to the world anymore except as a memory of what they have done in the past. But I also imagine for someone who just the joy of their body, joy of competition, joy of being engaged, and it doesn't really matter if they win or lose. What's important is just the joy of doing their best. And so they find themselves in the Olympics and they do their best and they end up last and they just smile, just they're happy, I was really engaged. So the ego is not tied into it. So I think if the Buddha was, in the Olympics, if he was a gymnast, or what would the Buddha be doing in the Olympics? Then I think he'd be happy whether he lost or won. And I've known people who've had that way, who've had that approach. Now, what that might entail, though, is that the person who's happy either way might lose some of the competitive ability. And then the question is it worth being happy if you lose your competitive edge? And I think for many people here in the West, there's such great value in winning that people can look down a little bit on the value of happiness if it takes away your competitive edge, if it makes you less efficient. And the question is, do we want to live our lives based on values of efficiency and winning and getting ahead, or on our happiness? So I can imagine that, the extra motivation, the extra determination, the anger or the fear that or whatever that might be missing in someone like a Buddha who does their very best, but the extra little push is not there. And it could work the other way too. It could work that someone like a Buddha, someone who's really familiar with themselves and has no greed and no fear and no desire, isn't burdened by those things. And so when they compete, their mind is really clear and focused and concentrated. And that gives them a competitive edge.
Definitely in the moment.
So, but what interests me is that people who want to justify sometimes greed or anger or because you're more likely to win or more likely to be efficient because of that. And it's true, you might be, but is that the foundation upon which we want our life to be run?
I have a question about motivation and one of the precepts, which is to not take what is not given. And it's what I consider practical Buddhism, when I get out in life and how do I act in the world based on the precepts and what I know to be the right thing to do. On Friday night, I went to a poetry reading by David White in the city, and I had one ticket for myself, and I didn't have a ticket for a friend of mine. And I was planning to somehow, some people sell tickets outside the door, etc. Anyway, long story short is that there were a shortage of tickets. There was a lot of people who wanted to buy a ticket at the door. And someone ended up approaching us and saying, hey, look at, take my ticket stub because there you know me. I'm a well-known person here and I can just walk in and so you can take my ticket stub. Now, my motivation is I really wanted my friend to see David White. And actually, my friend, who is not a Buddhist, wouldn't do it, but I would. And so I thought, we ended up seeing poetry readings. And this gentleman told us he would just make a donation to Sarah. So my question is, we do talk a lot about motivation and why we do things. And so it was actually not really ethical. On the other hand, was the motivation okay? So, and I wonder about it. Obviously, I'm still thinking about it.
The usual way of, in our particular circles of Buddhism, to look at the precepts is as guidelines for reflection, to look at motivation, for example. But the reflection is in two directions. One is to look at ourselves and our motivation, what's going on inside of us, but also to help us reflect on what the consequences is to the society around us. And not just to be self-focused, but also be other-focused in a sense. And to use that reflection to clarify the particular situation we find ourselves in. And then from that kind of situation, understanding the situation, deciding how to act, as opposed to taking some kind of hard and fast rule approach to the precepts. And just say, well, the rule is, no, take what's not given, so I'm not going to do that. But never then using that as an opportunity for deeper self-reflection and transformation. So that's for you to do that work. Now, to look at the motivation, is the motivation wholesome or is it unwholesome? To want your friend, maybe your friend is on the verge of full enlightenment, and David White has this particular thing, a way of kind of phrasing things that you're convinced is going to really help this person, and maybe in the balance of things, the tremendous amount of good that's going to come is it balances out. And maybe not. In traditional Theravada analysis of ethics, which I don't necessarily agree with, but I think it's well worth knowing and kind of reflecting on, is that there's an assumption that anything you do, that any breaking of the precept entails some unwholesome motivation within us, some clinging or some fear or some hate or something. And so, in very traditional Theravadan Buddhism, then you would really avoid breaking any of the precepts because of the belief that then you're avoiding contaminating yourself with some greed or some hate. To kind of do a little tangential discussion about death again, in very traditional Theravadan Buddhism, euthanasia is usually not condoned. And usually the reason it's given, I'm not saying I agree with this, but the reason it's given is that euthanasia in the sense that not just simply letting someone die is a matter of course, but doing something like giving them an injection or something. And the reason for that is very personal. I say a doctor or whoever cannot do the killing, the mercy killing, without some amount of aversion operating. And as long as that aversion is operating, that person who's doing the killing is creating tremendous bad karma for themselves. And so, for the sake of the person who's doing the killing, you don't do it for that. You don't do it because you don't want to create that kind of bad karma. So, from one traditional point of view, any breaking of the precept entails some kind of negative motivation. And so, if that's the case, then the really careful, honest reflection on this issue will probably show that's the case. Now, I don't necessarily agree with that, but I think it's probably more often true than not. So to really understand that, and motivation is a very, very tricky thing to study because there can be a surface motivation that's the most obvious one, but not necessarily the one that's really operating. And, or the surface motivation might look altruistic, but if you look kind of behind that, what motivates that motivation? And it might be that, your friend is on the verge of some great breakthrough if they hear David White. But really what you want is you want your friend to really like you for having brought you to a place where they had a great breakthrough. And so there's often secondary and tertiary kind of motivations that are kind of the supporting or the root of what appears on the surface for the reason we're doing things. So to study the motivation, we have to kind of look really carefully and deeply. And then also, I mean, I think ethical analysis also has to take some reflection about the situation we're in, the wider situation, the impact it has on others. And perhaps, you know, you're standing at the edge of the door and no one else is coming in. Everyone else has given up because they realize there's no tickets. They've been told that. So all the people who possibly wanted to come no longer wants to come. But you happen to still be standing at the door, and David White's about to start reading, and you notice that, in fact, there is one chair still empty. You know, two of them, one for you, you give a ticket, and one other one. And it seems a pity to go home and leave, you know, this empty seat there when, you know, your friend is here, could benefit from it. So what do you do in that kind of situation? You know, what is the impact does that have? Maybe in that kind of situation it's okay, because on the other hand, is there an impact on wider society for us to break the rules of society? You know, what are the ways in which we influence each other? If one person cheats on their taxes, does it make it easier for someone else to cheat on their taxes? Because then we could be creating a culture of people who kind of cheating a little bit here and there. So, you know, what's the impact of our decisions? You know, should it maybe hopefully be part of the analysis, part of the consideration. In traditional Theravadan Buddhism, one of the reasons people are advocating following the precepts is so that people will recognize you as someone who's ethical, and so that your reputation of virtue will precede you as you go in society. And so when you go into a group of people, you enter blamelessly. And the value of living a blameless life is held up really high in Theravadan Buddhism. And now, if you did something, you basically felt it was okay to do it. It seemed fine kind of to do it. But in fact, you leave, and you come and tell your meditation group what you've done, and you feel a little pang of kind of, you know, a little bit kind of embarrassment in doing it. You know, is that the way you want to live your life, kind of going around with that little pang of embarrassment? Maybe it is. Maybe it's okay, given the balance of all the different things you can consider. But what's the consequences to the society around you, and the way the society sees you, and also in the way that society is either supported in its effort to be ethical? And I overheard a discussion on the radio some months ago. I think it was a South American writer, political scientist or something, analyzing why capitalism doesn't seem to work in countries like South America or Russia. And his analysis was that it doesn't work because they're not societies based on law, whereas America is a society based on law. And everybody, not everyone, but enough people here kind of follow the law well enough. And so when you say something or you sign a contract, here you can kind of count on it, people following through. But he claimed, as a South American, that down his country, that things aren't based on law down there. And so when you want things to get done, then you can't count on it. So you end up with a lot of illegal activity. The mafia, he said, was a big consequence of when you don't have a culture based on law and respect for law. So, you know, I don't know how to answer your question for you. But in our circles, the Vipassana circles, the emphasis on these kinds of questions is to, each time they come up, is not to have some preconceived idea of what the right thing to do is, but to enter the question very deeply and reflect on it. And that's for you to do. Yes?
The discussion on that triggered... I didn't realize that I had sort of repressed it since I saw the Bill Moyers program on death, and I remembered how much that triggered in me. And some thoughts I have about that are, at the end of each program, by the each one, I was getting sadder and sadder towards the end. And I was surprised because one of the most important things for me right now that I've gotten from being part of the Buddhist practice is coming to terms with death, because I didn't grow up in this culture getting any tools to do that. And it had brought me closer. And I was surprised when you became intimate with these people on the screen, you really got into their life. And then there would be another section and they weren't there. And then you actually saw them disposing of the ashes. It really triggered something that I had thought I was getting a hold of, but I realized I wasn't, and that I needed to go deeper. And then one thing I read something Thich Nhat Hanh said, I think that's what I read, you were never born. And that was such a relief. And I don't know, I can't even say that. You were never born and you will never die. It's like it took it out of this immediate thing I'm living with every day, you know, that I've been repressing so much. So I think there's so much there. And I think in the consciousness, these programs have brought up things that are sitting in the culture that aren't being dealt with. And I think this practice is really good. And I feel really thankful that I do, that I'm getting some tools to deal with it, but I can see I'm really still on the surface, you know, but I do feel like at least there's a relief that if I go deeper into it, there's a path to go deeper.
Yes,
grounding.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah.
I think maybe one thing about the Bill Moyers program that might have been a more complete experience is if you would have been allowed to see any of those people actually die. Mm-hmm. And for obvious reasons, they didn't show that. The closest that they came was when the man was explaining what to look for to know when somebody was dying. But I myself felt that I was being cheated as part of the process by not actually seeing one of those people that I had become somewhat knowledgeable about actually die. So that was just...
Yeah. And then I thought, well, I was thinking it would be really valuable to be part of the hospice, go through that program. And then I realized, I don't know if I had the courage yet to do that. It would take courage to do that, because then you're really getting there. That opened those doors to me.
There's a lot of Bay Area Buddhist practitioners have been strongly drawn to do hospice work as a kind of a, not so much for, you know, to help someone else, but rather for themselves, because it's such an honest confrontation with these issues. We're very lucky to have the Zen Hospice here in the Bay Area.
But is that using it for your own? Like using someone else's?
No. That's a good question. And what?
I would say
Sorry?
I would say that's not really possible if you're really serving that person and if you've been trained appropriately to be with that person. You have some familiarity with this training that's done. That's, you know, whether it's Zen Hospice or the Nipa Hospice or any other hospice that's well managed, the volunteer training will really have a lot to do with the fact that you, I don't see how you could possibly use the person if you really got the training first.
Or it might be motivation.
Yeah.
That's really with anything. Any volunteer job you do, you realize that for a while you would get the benefit of the people you volunteer with.
You're just saying that because it's amazing.
It really is both. It's an exchange.
I didn't hear what you said.
Yeah, I think as Cheryl said, it's often both. Everyone hopefully benefits, but I think it's important to look at the motivation, and it's a little bit tricky to understand. There's so much narcissism in our culture. That if it's just for ourselves, it can be problematic. On the other hand, I remember reading Stephen Levine's book, Who Dies? I think it was in there. And he talking about the problems that come when we go sit at the bedside of someone. We're there to help them, and they don't want to be helped in the kind of way that some people want to come and help. And so the best motivation to go is really you're going there kind of just to be present for someone, not going there to help. And you know, so there is a way in which the only person we can really change is ourselves. So I think there's something very appropriate about understanding that we're also doing it for ourselves. There's a beautiful story or metaphor that's told in the Buddhist texts. There were these two acrobats, and acrobat and his apprentice, and they were the apprentice was going to stand on the ground, and the acrobat was going to stand up on his shoulders and do various acrobatic tricks. And so the acrobat said to his assistant, "You pay attention to me, and in paying attention to me, you can protect me when I'm up there. And I'll pay attention to you, and while I'm paying attention to you, I'll protect you." And the assistant said, "No, it's not like that. You watch yourself, and in watching yourself, you protect me. And I'll watch myself, and in watching myself, I'll protect you." And the Buddha heard this, and he said, "Oh, this is a very wise apprentice, assistant to the acrobat. And this is the way it works, is that if you carefully watch yourself, then you'll naturally protect other people." The Buddha went on to say, in protecting other people, you protect yourself. There's often kind of goes both directions. So I'm kind of rambling a little bit here, but there's a famous story of Gandhi being asked about, you know, why he did all the work he did in freeing India from England. And it goes something like this. He said, "Are you doing it for the sake of, you know, the English or the sake of the Indians?" He said, "No." "And why are you doing all this?" And it kind of follows these various possibilities. And finally he said, "I'm just doing it for my own sake, you know, for my own liberation." And he did phenomenal amount of altruistic work. But he understood it being, he understood that it was really for himself. So the interface between what we do for ourselves and what we do for others is a very rich one, very important one to explore, and not so, I think, so straightforward to understand. Enough people have been so-called altruistic, and in doing that, haven't understood themselves very well, and have imposed their bias and their prejudice on someone else. And so without some kind of clear understanding of ourselves and liberation of ourselves, it's dangerous to be of service to others. I think that continue the rambling a little bit on this. For me, one of the ideals is we can't necessarily know the purity of our motivation completely, and we don't want to be frozen, inhibited from acting in the world either. But if we try to bring as much mindfulness to our activities as we can, then if we're mindful when we go into service, then some of the clarification and purification can happen in the activity. And we don't have to sit, hold back, and wait until we're completely clear and pure in our motivation. And part of the value of service comes to us because of the focus on being mindful while we do it. If we're just doing it for the sake of doing it for others and not paying attention to ourselves as we do it, then it can be a little bit off. But if we go in there with that mindfulness at the same time, then I think it can be a very powerful area. So those are my thoughts. I very much appreciated hearing your concerns and your questions. For me, it's felt very real, very, very significant to hear the kind of questions you have and concerns. And I hope that all of you appreciated this format we can do sometimes. And also, I really liked sitting in a circle a lot. So often, maybe it's a little bit hard to do when we have bigger numbers, but when we have these kinds of numbers, I think it works really great. So next week, Mark Coleman will be here, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. Thank you.